this evening. I think we have a brilliant topic, and the shame is that this is the sort of topic that like 150 people should have been here. But it's hard to convince people to care about this unless they work for the university or unless they have some experience with the really great stuff that the ACLU of Virginia does. We are really lucky to have this evening Kent Willis, the Executive Director of the ACLU of Virginia. The idea of me going to the ACLU and saying, could you do me a favor, is just stupid. I have gone to the ACLU three times they've actually saved my bacon legally over the years, under Kent Willis every time. So me asking, like, do me a solid, man, is ridiculous, because I owe them a lot. But Kent Willis, the Executive Director, is here with us this evening to talk to us about the case, which I understand, and yet when somebody asks me about it, I'm incapable of explaining it. The case of Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, I don't want to say subpoenaing, that's not the right word, and I guess Kent will explain, but demanding information from the University of Virginia for climate records, from email records of a climate researcher at the University of Virginia. It seems like both a simple and a very confusing case, and Kent is going to shed some light on us for us. A few notes about Kent. He's been the executive director of the ACLU for, I think, is this your 20th anniversary year?
Actually, 89, so
21,
oh, so 21
years. 21 years in the executive director at the ACLU. Previously, he was the executive director of Housing Opportunities Made Equal. He is a Virginian. He's a William & Mary graduate. And this is, I think, a noteworthy bit, he is not an attorney, which I think is awesome. I think we need more people working in the legal field who are not attorneys. I know that sounds ridiculous, but you get a totally different perspective. So, for the next half hour, 40 minutes or so, Kent will be explaining this case and taking y'all's questions and explaining the ACLU of Virginia better than I could.
Thank you. By the way, the first time Waldo came to the ACLU, he was actually a minor. Am I not correct? He was 17, and he was challenging the Charlottesville curfew ordinance. So we do go way back. Before I get started, I want to say just a couple of things about the ACLU and the ACLU of Virginia. Everybody here probably has at least heard of the ACLU. We're the state affiliate of the national ACLU. The ACLU is set up in a very unusual way for national organizations. The state affiliates are independently incorporated, independently run organizations affiliated with the national office. About the only thing we do is share resources. We both do fundraising, and then we put it all in a pot, and we get some of it, and the national office gets some of it for obvious reasons. And there are some rules and regulations, but we're not like most affiliates of a national organization where we take our marching orders from national. We decide what lawsuits we're going to file. There is a tradition in the ACLU that by the time you get to the U.S. Supreme Court, you will have contacted the national office and sought their opinion. But even then, you're not required to do that. There is a lot of interaction, of course, but it's in a helpful sort of way, not in an administrative kind of way. We also make our own decision about priorities, legislative priorities, public education priorities. What we want to work on in general are our own independent decisions here, and those are decided sort of priority-wise by the board of directors, and then we have a staff. The total staff in Virginia, I don't like to say this publicly, it's 9 people, and the reason is because newspapers often refer to the army of attorneys working for the ACLU, and I don't like to dispel them of that notion.
Right, exactly.
We have a baseball team. We actually have a couple of attorneys on staff. One of the things we do depend on, though, are volunteer attorneys. If the heart and soul of the ACLU in general is litigation around constitutional issues, then the sort of heart and soul of our labor are what we call cooperating attorneys, which are volunteer attorneys who work with our staff attorneys on cases. If the attorney has time, interest, and knowledge, they can be the lead attorney in a case. If they just want to help out, they can be second chair, essentially, to our attorney. But that's sort of how we operate. So it's this. There are a lot of volunteers. There really, literally are scores of volunteer attorneys across the state, and they're the ones that enable us to do much of the work that we do. Our work's divided into 3 categories. Litigation, which no doubt you've heard about because that's primarily what we're noted for. We also have a public education program, which includes things like this. And we do lobbying in the Virginia General Assembly. I have two publications I brought with me today. This is our last newsletter, which is from about a month or so ago, and there are copies back there. If any, it'll just give you a sense of what we've been doing for the last 6 months or so. This publication is a little more specific. This is a description of the cases we have in court right now. It's also a description of the time. One of the things that's happened as a result of our suing and suing fairly often is we don't have to sue all the time. We simply write a letter and say, we promise to sue you unless you do this, and they do it. And so this also lists all those times where we didn't have to go to court, which you think about it is pretty economical. So anyway, if you're interested in these things, they are back there. And the other thing I'm going to pass around is we have email communications with anyone who's interested. There are two primary ways of doing it. One we call e-news, which is an email about once a week that will usually bring you up to date on some action we've taken that week, a case we've resolved or a case that we've filed or some other kind of effort we've taken. The other is the grassroots lobbying. During the General Assembly, we have several people at the General Assembly. We'll monitor about 100 bills that affect civil liberties and civil rights, and we will lobby directly on about 50 or 60 of those bills. Probably the most effective thing we do in the General Assembly is to get what we call grassroots lobbyists to call their legislators to urge them to vote one way or another on a bill. So one of I think ultimately, the greatest influence we have is when someone like you calls your delegate or your senator and says, vote on the bill. What the lobbying aspect of this does is during the General Assembly, it'll send to you email saying, this bill is coming up tomorrow in this committee. Here's the nature of the bill. Here's what we suggest you say about it, or you can say anything you want. Here's the email address of your senator and your delegate. Phone number and so on, and urges you to get involved in that way. So I'm going to pass this around. If anybody's interested in signing up for that, we promise not to use this to solicit you for money. On the other hand, if you feel kind of a lump here, there are some membership envelopes. So if anyone's so inclined to join the ACLU either now or in a few minutes or afterwards, take an envelope with you. So Dennis, I'll start with you. I've known Dennis longer than I've known Waldo. Well, I'm going to talk about this issue tonight, and it's one that's sort of simple and complicated all at the same time. And so I'd like to sort of start with something that may not seem that directly involved, but it'll sort of lay the background for what's going on here. In 2001, Congress passed the Patriot Act, and everybody's heard of the Patriot Act. One of the things the Patriot Act did was give the government many new sort of broad authorities to essentially search and obtain information, not through the traditional way of going to court and getting a warrant, but through all kinds of administrative procedures that essentially bypassed the courts. That inspired a lot of states to do essentially the same thing. I think that one of the children of the Patriot Act is something called the Fraud Against Taxpayers Act in Virginia, which was passed in 2003. What that did was it gave the Attorney General the right to investigate any kind of fraud perpetrated against the state of Virginia. And as you can imagine, there are lots of ways of doing that. There are all kinds of people with monetary relationships with the state. And this is broad authority for him to investigate these kinds of claims when they come up. What the Fraud Against Taxpayers Act did was give him the power, and someone's already used the term of a CID, which is a civil investigative demand. And what that means is if the Attorney General looks out and sees something going on that he thinks is fraud against the state, then he can send a demand letter for information related to that fraud. He doesn't have to go to court to get a warrant, doesn't have to go get a subpoena, he doesn't have to file a lawsuit and use the sort of normal channels. He can go ahead and make this demand. The basis for making the demand, first of all, is he has to have reason to believe that fraud has occurred. That's a pretty broad term. But he also has to, when he makes a demand, state exactly what conduct he believes has taken place that's violated state law. So those are the two bases for him going out and sending these kind of demands out. Now, what happens now, though, is you don't have to just capitulate. By the way, the act, if you read it, talks about people. He may do this with people, people, people. So it's the sort of thing that the Attorney General could come after any single individual in here or anywhere if he feels like they fall under this act. In this case, of course, he's gone after the University of Virginia. So, but then what the law does allow is that if you've been served one of these demand letters, you have a choice. You can give up the information, cough it up, hand it over, which is, of course, what they expect most people to do. Most people, particularly if they think they're innocent, and they get something like this from someone as powerful as the Attorney General, they choose not to fight them. That's probably the basic notion behind the act, is that most of the time, the Attorney General, when using something like this, can just sort of push people around. But the act does allow for the recipients of these demands to go to court and require a court to decide if indeed the demand is appropriate. And that's kind of moves us up to where we are with the University of Virginia. What I want to do is skip ahead now kind of to the bottom line here, because the bottom line here is, in between here is going to be a whole lot of stuff that's kind of boring, I think, actually, but I'll give you that. But the bottom line is about academic freedom. And academic freedom is an interesting concept in itself because you won't find it explicitly stated in the Constitution. You won't even find a whole lot of case law on it. We all have this notion that academic freedom is like free speech. It's something that sort of inherently belongs to our academic institutions, and it's constitutionally protected. And the truth is, the law on academic freedom is pretty sparse. There are a couple of U.S. Supreme Court cases that talk about academic freedom and sort of state the parameters of what they mean by that, but they're kind of narrow in scope. So even though we're dealing with this big, broad, important constitutional issue, it's not standing on as strong court grounds as we might like to think it would be. So now we go back to Ken Cuccinelli, because a whole lot of things have sort of confluded here to create this problem. First of all, as most of you know, just to make sure everybody knows, the Ken Cuccinelli sent this demand letter to UVA asking for basically every conceivable record there is on Dr. Michael Mann, a professor at UVA who is now at Penn State. And Professor Mann is a global warming expert who's published a number of papers on this issue. And so Cuccinelli, first of all, the demand itself is pretty... Hold on a second. Let's see how impressive this is. No, I don't have it. The letter demanding information on Dr. Mann is like this long. It's like 30-some pages long. We're not talking about a letter saying, by the way, we think this guy did something wrong. Would you send us copies of his reports, this and this? It is hard drives, emails, laptop. They want him to, in 30 pages of letters, 30 pages of request, to go through every single conceivable record you can imagine related to this person. Personal communications, anything that the university has. First of all, it's an incredibly burdensome demand to do that, going back to 1999, from 1999 to 2010. So it's a huge demand. It's also a huge, we think of it as sort of an invasion of privacy, but the notion of free speech and academic freedom carries with it this notion of private communications, private associations. Your right to communicate about these things without the government looking over your shoulder is, we feel, protected by the First Amendment. This is a very detailed request. It asks for any communications with, and it makes a list of 38 individuals, all other scientists that he communicated with during that time. Plus, like I said, anything related to any of the studies he did on global warming. It is a demand that is unprecedented in the sense that no Attorney General of Virginia has ever used the FATA for this kind of overly broad demand. Now, the other issue here, of course, and probably most of you know this, is Cuccinelli has done a number of stupid things since he came to office. In fact, yeah, I think they've got a little timer. It's like it's been a week, and we haven't done anything really idiotic, so let's do something again. And because I love the litany, I'll go through them quickly. You may recall the first thing he did is related to this. He filed a lawsuit essentially challenging the EPA greenhouse gas standards. And, of course, this is a purely business decision. It's also an ideological point that he's making. So he filed this clear loser of a lawsuit that showed exactly where he is on the issue of global warming and environmental impact. The next thing he did was send a letter to every university president in Virginia, and he said, by the way, I am now, for the first time, interpreting Virginia law to say that any university that has a policy preventing discrimination against gays and lesbians is violating Virginia law. It was pure crap. I will give you that. It was pure crap. He made this up out of whole cloth. What he claimed was, everybody knows about the Dillon Rule, where municipalities can't enact particular laws of their own without permission from the state first. Virginia is one of a handful of states that uses the Dillon Rule, and it sort of handcuffs localities in terms of what they can do. What he claimed that there was a kind of Dillon Rule analogy to the way universities operate, so that a state university in Virginia cannot have a policy protecting gays and lesbians without specific permission from the legislature. And so he sent that letter out, and he demanded that all of them, advised all of them, that they rescind whatever policies they have. Once again, the same kind of thing. First of all, sort of legally wacky reasoning, and second of all, clearly ideologically, politically based. You know, here he was. He's made his anti-environment standard statement. Now he gets to make his anti-gay and lesbian rights statement. Where he was wrong, by the way, about that, and I won't dwell on this because it's not the topic, is that first of all, the Dillon Rule analogy is ridiculous. It doesn't apply to universities and never will. Second of all, what he left out of his letter is this. The U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted the Constitution of the United States to prevent governmental entities from discriminating against gays and lesbians. There are a series of cases, mostly in the last 10 or 15 years, that have been interpreted over and over again by the lower courts to mean that the government can't discriminate against gays and lesbians. And so universities not only can they have these policies, they're obligated to have these policies. Yet he was saying they couldn't have them. And you may remember what happened with this. This caused Governor McDonnell, of all people, to scramble to the left a little bit, because now he's got this nutty attorney general making these sort of crazy coming up with these crazy legal theories and this sort of gay bashing that he was doing as a result of this. And so that caused McDonnell to issue his executive directive number one, which was basically the statement I just made, that whether or not state law, whatever state law does, the Constitution prevents you from discriminating against, if you're a state university, against gays and lesbians, so don't do it. But it's been that sort of nutty thing. And of course, then he covered the vitreous on the state flag. He covered her breasts with a armor thing, right? And that was his next thing. The next thing was this thing that we're talking about here. And by the way, I'll have to invite you by our office for this. A few years ago, we represented a Chesterfield High School art teacher. That art teacher, in his own time, on his own money, painted art at home, like probably any art teacher would do. And he sold it on the internet. And it just so happened that he had an unusual way of painting, and that is he applied paint to canvas using body parts, largely his buttocks. And so he became known as the butt painter. And he was fired from his job for doing that. And we represented him in court and we won his case for him. First Amendment case, public schools can't fire you for what you your private expression, which is a good, solid ACLU kind of case. So he called me afterwards, thanked us, and said, you know, what I want to do is to do a painting for you. And I thought, well, why not, you know? We have a lot of space in our conference room. And so I assumed, what he did lots of was flowers and things like that. And you can see the petals and the buttocks and things. And so So anyway, he marches into the office about a month later carrying a painting that's about 8 feet long and about 5 feet high, and it's a Virginia state flag, which he has rendered with his body parts. And I will tell you, if you come to our office and look at it, he rendered it with every single body part. So it's an interesting thing to look at. So we offered to Ken Cuccinelli an alternative, an antidote to his covering the breast of vitreous on the state flag and saying that maybe what he would like to do is adopt our version of the state flag as his seal. And he didn't return that email. But the next thing he did was this thing, this other sort of ideologically motivated, I think legally very iffy thing by going to the University of Virginia and demanding all of these records. Now, he's got this law as I described it on his side. The first thing that happened to this, and this is what actually bothered us the most, and it's exactly what you would expect from this, is the first rumblings from the University of Virginia, once they had gotten this demand, were to indicate that they indeed were going to capitulate. He's asked for this. He's the attorney general. We'll send him the information. Those, at least, were the quotes we saw in the newspaper. We immediately began looking for ways to counter this. And what we did is we contacted the American Association of University Professors, figuring they would have some influence with UVA. And we and the AAUP wrote a letter to the University of Virginia saying, listen, you may not know this even. You may not have looked at the law, but just because it's the Attorney General asking for this, don't capitulate. You have a right to fight this, and we urge you to do it. We urge you to do it because, one, the law allows you to do it, and, two, your obligation is to academic freedom, not to sort of meet the sort of whimsical or arbitrary or ideologically motivated demands of the Attorney General. We also talked to the Union of Concerned Scientists. They wrote Cuccinelli. They took the other route, trying to get him to withdraw the demand, which he didn't do. What happened ultimately was the university did what it had to do, or what it should have done, and it hired a law firm to represent them in this case. Now, here's what's an interesting little twist. If you go and ask anybody, who is the lawyer for the University of Virginia, you know what they'll tell you? It's the Attorney General, because the Attorney General is the lawyer for all the state colleges. So there's a kind of a bizarre relationship here, and that's why UVA has gone to outside counsel, a private attorney, because they are in this sort of no one even seems to really quite understand that relationship. Oh, and by the way, before I answer this question, what I meant to say as I started talking is that if you have a question, ask me. I'm happy to stop. I'll just jabber on, but I'm delighted to go in whatever direction you want with a question. In fact, that'll be more fun for me. So
UVA is a charter institution, and it only gets like 8% of its funding from the state. It's more of a quasi-state organization at this point. It's not truly a state.
I'm sorry. The issue here, and it's one that applies to UVA, other state colleges as well, and lots of other entities these days, is that only about 8% of, and I didn't know it was so low, only about 8% of UVA's funding actually comes from the state. And the question is, does that make it is it not then more of a private organization? And the truth is, it is still a state university. It is a state university. It is subject to all the rules of state universities. And it is chartered by the state. Now, whether they have the power to literally separate themselves from the state, I don't know. I doubt it, because they're chartered by the state. There are other schools that hit. You may recall some time ago, VMI, for example. Wait a minute, say that again?
We voted on it 2 years ago. They do have the power to separate.
Okay, we is...
I don't remember who.
But there was some sort of vote in the General Assembly or at the university? Some.
The undergrads couldn't vote, but I myself was only a grad student.
Right. But so what you're saying is I don't know the answer to this, obviously. Does anybody know this? What I do know is that a few years ago, when we were challenging...
No. You can bring it up. Student body did not bring it up. The administration...
And the administration... Was the administration seeking the opinion of the student body, or...
The student body was there to vote, but they wanted to do it.
Right, okay.
Okay.
Okay. What's
that?
Right.
Still governed to state law.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean.
He's referring to had to do with the charter status, which was not just about whether you could raise tuition. It was about whether or not UVA needed, since it's actually, I believe, 6% of their funding is all that they're currently getting from the state. Since they were getting so little funding from the state, did they need to be subject, if they self-chartered, did they need to be subject to all the state bureaucratic rules?
Right.
If they wanted to build a new library, did they have to follow all protocols of the state? And they took a vote on that, and you're saying that the vote came out that they did not want to become an independent charter school, but they are still subject to the state rules.
Okay.
At the time, there were a few main factors. Those students didn't want it because it cost them more. Everybody else wanted it because they would have more freedom. The two basic consequences would be tuition would go up slightly, but the institution as a whole would be granted the same freedom as a private institution.
Okay.
At the time, you say 8%, you say 6%, there was a prime 4%.
And I remember.
No. I actually work at UVA. I know this pretty well.
Okay. Oh, good. Let's get the final on this. Because I'll tell you why. Whether or not UVA is a state university, they're still subject to the Fraud Against Taxpayers Act, CID. Okay. But do you want to clarify this for everyone?
Let's not get off track.
Okay.
It's still a state university.
Okay. So now I'm thrown off. Does anybody have any questions so I can get back on track?
Yeah.
But not about the charter status, UVA. Good.
Were there any ethical problems with the people in the education section who accounted for the university advising the university to go against their boss? I mean, I would have been on the phone to the State Bar Ethics Hotline in a minute.
Right.
I mean, was that part of the issue, that they were getting bad advice from the people?
Well, it's interesting because despite the sort of aggressive stance of the AG, it was clear that there had been communications. I'm just saying this from information I picked up. There had been communications before and some agreement, not before the CID was filed, but after it was filed and they began communicating. And in fact, in UVA's petition that it filed in court that we'll get to in a second, it talks about the fact that the AG essentially gave them permission to go hire a private attorney for this. So those communications took place. It sounds to me like there probably were ethical questions. What they had to do is sit down and resolve, okay, how do we do this with the AG filing this demand against one of his own entities or one of the state's own entities, and this is how they resolved it. So UVA did ultimately decide, of course, to fight this. And they have filed, the way the law works is, you file a petition in the circuit court where you reside. The law always uses the word people, so it's simpler when you're understanding it that way. Now, UVA is in Albemarle, right? It's not actually in Charlotte. I never quite get that straight. Yeah, so it's Albemarle Circuit Court. So UVA ultimately filed a petition in circuit court, and now they're doing what, regardless of what the AG's motives are here, regardless of everything, UVA should fight this the CID by going to court. Because what they're doing is they're taking this issue before an arbitrator. And before you automatically give up anything to the government in any situation like this, that just makes sense to do it. Whether you think his motives are good, bad, or indifferent, it makes sense. Besides, this law has been used very infrequently in Virginia, and we know it's the first time it's been used against an academic institution. So the last thing anybody who cares about academic freedom wants is to set a precedent of not fighting this. What they're going to do here, even if they lose, is they'll set the precedent of, okay, you asked for this information, we're going to go to court, and we're going to make you work for it. And working for it is something that the law does require the Attorney General to do. So here's what UVA is doing. It's going to court and it's saying, first of all, the Attorney General had to have reason to believe that Michael Mann had committed fraud. We don't have any indication of that whatsoever, and they haven't made any statement of that. Second of all, they have to state the conduct that he participated in that violates the FATA in Virginia, and they made no such statement. They simply wrote the thing saying, give us the information. So they're starting out on a couple of, I would call, technical grounds by saying that basically the CID is flawed. They're making some other arguments that are technical arguments, and one of them is that the CID is looking into five pieces of research that Dr. Mann did that he received funding for. And one of the arguments they're making is, well, first of all, four of them were federally funded. And this is fraud against Virginia taxpayers. It has nothing to do with the federal government at all. So those are out. You can't even ask for anything about that. You're not even in compliance with the law by asking about grants that were done like that. One of them was actually, and this is an interesting argument, it was an internally funded grant by UVA itself. It wasn't like they went to the legislature or went to some other entity like that. It was internally done by UVA. That's a sort of harder argument because UVA is still part of the state. But it's an interesting argument. The other argument they're making here is this. The law was passed in 2003. The grant was given in 2001. And I think that almost all of the research done under that grant was finished by 2003. And the law doesn't apply retroactively. So the other technical argument UVA is making is that none of the five studies that this guy did technically should come under the jurisdiction of this law. And so these are all things that UVA is going to stand up in circuit court and say to a circuit court judge. The other argument they're making, and this is where we get to the broad picture toward the end, is this kind of overbroad, intrusive demand violates academic freedom. This is the hardest argument of all in a way, but it's also kind of most persuasive in terms of what this is all about. So I think it's very important that even if a circuit court judge doesn't feel qualified to talk about what academic freedom is and how it applies here, that the arguments are made and they're laid out so that the court will see them. Then we'll just see what happens. I mean, that's sort of where we are with this. This will be the first time something like this has happened. It's happened, you know, Cuccinelli's own reputation will hurt him as this inquiry goes. I mean, one of the things that courts look at, not necessarily in terms of sort of legal, not in legal terms, but in terms of in meaningful terms, is whether you're doing something in good faith or bad faith. Cuccinelli's got bad faith written all over him with this. No matter what, UVA, I think, sort of ends up taking the right stand. They end up setting the right precedent, win or lose. That's what's going to be important. And what we hope, of course, is that UVA wins out. Now, part of what the court can do under this law is simply narrow the scope. It doesn't have to throw out the CID. So it can take those 30 pages of demands and say, well, only this little piece of it is relevant, or this big piece of it is relevant, or it can throw it out altogether. It's the kind of thing where you're likely to end up with a sort of partial victory, where the typical circuit court judge is going to look to sort of split the baby a little bit. But even if UVA ends up narrowing the scope of this considerably, I think it'll be a winner in that regard. The loser would have been if UVA chose not to do anything. Yes?
That one of the arguments is that he has not said what the fraud is, but presumably he's got to have something in mind. And do you have any sense of what he's claiming or will claim that fraud?
Yeah, the question is what will Cuccinelli claim? I mean, clearly he does have something more than the fact that he hates global warming theorists, right? Maybe not, but let's assume that he's smart enough to have some basis for this. As you may know, Dr. Mann actually, do you know about ClimateGate? Mann was one of the people that was implicated by ClimateGate. Stolen emails and communications that came out that seemed to indicate possibly that some of the numbers being generated for global warming weren't quite on par. But the truth is that after that came out, all of that's been studied. Mann himself and the other people associated that have been, the wrong word is exonerated, but have basically been exonerated in that. Also, the Penn State, where Mann has gone to, did its own separate inquiry of this issue, and they also said everything's okay. And, of course, the thing that's most important here, and it's one of the arguments that needs to be made in court, and I hope that the only argument UVA has made so far is kind of a bare bones argument. This is going to be briefed, by the way. In other words, right now you have UVA with about a 10-page statement of what it tends to do. There's going to probably be a 100 or 200-page statement about what this is all about. And one of the things that it needs to do is to, and I'm sure it will, is talk about academic freedom broadly, talk about a particular subcategory of academic freedom, which is scientific inquiry, and from that talk about peer review. The argument can be made that this is something that time has proven can take care of itself. Peer review for scientists is pretty stringent stuff. I mean, in fact, it's what you're supposed to do, right? Anytime you come up, someone comes up with a theory, the idea is that people try to knock it down. And so the point will be made that there has been significant peer review of the kind of work that Mann has done. But Cuccinelli, because of ClimateGate, because of some of those inquiries are not yet totally finished yet. He probably has just enough to hang his hat on with that. Yes?
I wanted to hear some more about the academic freedom argument, but I'm not understanding that. But in terms of peer review, fraud does exist in science. I mean, that is without a doubt. I mean, fraudulent science has gone through peer review and existed for long periods of time.
Sure.
And it's also been involved in, there's been fraud in getting funding. So it's not like peer review and the scientific method keep this clean. So there is definitely problems with fraud. So I'd like to know a little bit more about the academic freedom argument about how this is an impingement on academic freedom.
Yeah, and as I said earlier, it's actually a hard argument that we sort of all have a sense of, but isn't articulated very well in Supreme Court cases. And by the way, from a federal court standpoint, individual academic freedom sort of doesn't exist. In other words, the individual professor's academic freedom is, and in fact, if you look at cases out of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we've lost these cases, so I know them, the right of the state to determine what someone it hires, what they do with their time, is it's pretty complete. We lost a case. I hate talking about losing cases, but it's a case called Yourofsky. A few years back, the General Assembly passed a law saying that you couldn't use state-owned computers to access, or state-owned anything, but it was obviously about computers, to access sexually explicit materials. I think it was entirely on the Internet. We represented about 8 different professors in Virginia whose, in the course of their studies, access sexually explicit material. One of the problems is, what is sexually explicit? They weren't saying pornography or obscenity. They were saying sexually explicit. And so we represented a bunch of professors, all of whom during the course of their regular research accessed this kind of information. And we lost that case. And what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals says, that nope, if they're employees of the state, the state can say what you do with your, what you do on the clock is the state's business, and there's no individual sense of academic freedom in that regard. Academic freedom, generally speaking, in the couple of Supreme Court cases that have dealt with it, is really about a sort of academic, an academy-wide or university-wide, the school's academic freedom, its right to choose its curriculum, its right to choose its priorities and its general directions. And so one of the interesting things here is, man's the guy they were after. The law would allow them to go directly to man for this information, but they've gone to the school. And I think there are two reasons, and this is something I'm not absolutely clear about and no one's clarified to me. I think they can't go after man because he's in Pennsylvania. Yeah. The law just doesn't extend there, even if he possibly committed some sort of fraud while in Virginia. And the other is, the university obviously has broader access to the kind of information that Cuccinelli wants. So when the argument for academic freedom here will be about the school's academic freedom, its right to protect its professors, its right to make these choices is the argument it's going to make. The truth is, as I was saying, academic freedom as a constitutional right, it's pretty weak ground. There are a couple of cases. There's one where in New York, the New York University was actually New York University was not allowing, wouldn't hire professors if they had any kind of connection with the Communist Party or other sort of progressive movements. And the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. You can't use that as a criteria for hiring people. And the other was the New Hampshire legislature created something like this, sort of, where they had they empowered the Attorney General to essentially inquire of college professors about what they were doing, why they were doing it. It was a kind of subpoena power to question everything they did. The U.S. Supreme Court said that they couldn't do that. That was overstepping the boundaries. So therefore, academic freedom in this general sense protected that. But we'll see. I mean, one of the good things is we're going to get a chance, I hope, to see some real good arguments developed here on what academic freedom is all about. And I'm told that my time is up. I didn't get this one yet, but I've been getting this for a while. Yeah.
I do want to point out that the first election of note in the contract recall is the 5th District. It is a clear win for Robert Hurd. Hurd is just a shame for Democrats.
What's the percentage, though?
Not quite 50%.
No, only
8% of the precincts have reported.
District
so far as of 5 years
ago.
But it's near 50%.
He has the best signs
because
it just says
Herbert,
U.S.
Congress. But the number of elections of note in the country have been called yet, of course, because so many are time zones behind. Is there any chance that, say, Cuccinelli actually is right, that there was fraud, is there a chance in the world that the state
taxpayers would ever get any money back from this, or is this going to end up costing taxpayers a lot of money?
Well, it depends on who. Well, first of all, Cuccinelli prevails. It depends on who ends up paying. The damage is actually a very, this law actually limits, this is civil, it's not criminal investigation. The damages are at between $5,500 and $11,000in damages. But you actually can also, that's actually in fines. In damages can be any amount. In other words, what the damage to the state was as a result of this, and you can give treble damages. So they can say this cost the state $500,000, multiply that by three, plus you have to pay the state's attorneys too. So the thing is who pays? UVA would pay, right? I'm sure the UVA, or an insurance company, depending. Oh, and by the way, we will be, this isn't in the news yet, but we have decided that we're going to do something unusual, and that is file a friend of the court brief in circuit court in Virginia. Friend of the court briefs are typically U.S. Supreme Court or appellate courts, but we're going to file one, and right now we have on board us, the American Association of University Professors, and the Union of Concerned Scientists. And we sent an email today to the Thomas Jefferson Center for Freedom of Expression to see if we can get them to come on board, too. We should be filing that soon.
Well, I guess I should just ask. Could you put your hand up if you want to have a few more minutes?
All right.
What
the hell? Okay.
Let's do three more questions.
Okay. Then you choose.
Well, on that same note, what's your opinion of the private law firm, how skilled they are?
You know, I don't, but first of all, I said Hogan, I wonder if that's Hogan Hartson. So it is what happened to Hogan and Hartson, right? Okay, so it's Hogan Hartson, which is one of the top law firms, in the nation. They're big wigs, and they do a lot of pro bono work. This probably isn't pro bono; they're getting paid, but they do this stuff.
Is the state paying for that too?
Well, the university is paying for it. You can decide whether 8% of the state. I'm not sure. Hogan and Hartson was the head of their pro bono division for many years is a guy named Elliot Mintzberg, who is the legal director for People for the American Way. I mean, they have a sort of a long liberal history of doing pro bono work. So, no, they've got top-notch people working on their behalf.
Have you read the documents about ClimateGate, all the stuff that's come out about that?
No, I'm not. I've read a little, enough to know, sort of know what it is, but I'm not.
This stems around an unfortunate use of a word that could be interpreted to be a twisting of data. Inspection that was done afterward of all of the people involved, and they had the outside people come in, and what they understood was that this was kind of a joke term that was being used in these emails back and forth. It wasn't intended to be any indication of fraud. It was just a kind of shorthand way of saying, well, you know, all of these numbers are open to interpretation, and this is how we're going to deal with it.
Okay.
It's not a matter of frauding anyone. And so if Cuccinelli's case is based upon that, and that's the only thing there's nothing else that could even be conceived of as fraud.
The word is a trick.
A trick. The word is a trick. It's not just that one. It's not just that one section.
Well, what would actually constitute fraud for a scientist who actually completed reports? If scientists are allowed to be wrong.
They're certainly allowed to be wrong, but particularly in procuring the grant. Now, that's what this is mostly about. This is about what he said in order to get the grant. If there's a sort of a blatant lie, an attempt to mislead, then they can, you know, they can make the argument that that's fraud. Yeah, that's right. That ClimateGate was not related to these earlier grants. Yeah.
But you could probably make an argument that's basically says Michael Mann and other people were making up climate change from day one, and thus they got grants later because they were making it up from day one.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, and all, all of this is arguable. One of the things that I've been saying to people, I've talked about this, I said, you know, one of the things, there are two things to we can separate this out here. One, this whole question, which we hopefully will answer, about whether the Attorney General knows something we don't know, or what we do know is enough to launch this kind of demand letter. But the other is, regardless of that, what we want UVA to do is to stand up for academic freedom by taking this to court and having a third party look at it, not capitulate. So even if, in other words, you win, we're going to win something out of this, even if Cuccinelli is right, because UVA will have taken a stand, and they will set the precedent of when this happens in the future, that universities at least question what he's done. I mean, it is interesting to me that, I mean, the most interesting thing here is the omission. Why didn't Cuccinelli, first of all, the law required him to state the conduct that was a violation of the law in his CID, and he didn't do that. Could be an oversight, but it seems conspicuous that that's missing. It seems to me that maybe the reason it's missing is because he knows it's a pretty weak argument. But we'll find that out. It might be a strong argument.
This, to a large extent, this seems like political grandstanding, laying groundwork for future political activities on Cuccinelli's part. And to what extent could public pressure, you know, if the people opposed to Cuccinelli and his activities get noisy and go to Richmond and do all this stuff, to what extent could that have an impact on this case? And is that useful? Do you want it to go to court, or would it be better to, you know, have public protest and try to do something to nip it in the bud?
Yeah. I'm a believer that you do all of these things, right? That you go to court, but there's nothing wrong with protesting, writing letters, putting pressure on public officials, because even if it doesn't affect this particular episode, it may affect the next one. Cuccinelli hasn't seemed to worry too much about things. You know, the other thing that he did recently, we actually agreed with him on, which was he was one of only two attorney generals in the entire United States that didn't sign on to an amicus brief in the Supreme Court about the Reverend Phelps case. And Reverend Phelps is the idiot Westboro Baptist Church minister that goes to military funerals and claims that people in the soldiers die because God thinks we're immoral. And Ruch and I was right about that one because it's a free speech issue. And there were 48 other, if 25 attorney generals had signed that, it wouldn't have surprised me, because you have 25 of them sort of pandering to the politics of the issue, which is, for God's sake, please stand on the side of the military and their families and these solemn occasions, which makes sense. But they're all lawyers. They're all lawyers. And 48 out of 50 lawyers actually abandoned the First Amendment of the Constitution to do a little political pandering. Cuccinelli didn't, and I don't know what he was thinking. I swear I don't know anything about this guy. Maybe he likes Phelps. Right. That could be it. That's right. 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 What's that? He did write that. He said that explicitly, that he found it deplorable. Right. Yeah. We do. Virginia amended its public disturbance law about 3 years ago to just list in it funerals among all the other things that are listed. But otherwise, it's a constitutional standard for what determines a public disturbance. By the way, I will tell you this, and this is unusual. I got a call from the chief assistant attorney general, not Ken himself, but from his top person about the time this came out. And he said, I'm calling you up because I think the ACLU is actually going to agree with us on something. If we come out in the paper and say we're doing this, are you going to say we're doing it right? And I said, of course. I don't have any problem with that. He said, oh, good. Right. So you never know. All right. I'm going to
answer a few questions.
Yeah.
And I do want to reiterate the call back to McKinley, which is that if you do feel strongly about this, represented either in the Senate
Thank you. Thank you.